Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 82, featuring Michael Wilkin from Saatchi & Saatchi. Before I get too much into that, I wanted to give a shout out to everyone who came to SIGGRAPH this year at Anaheim. It was this last week and able to check out our V-Ray days and all of that stuff. It was really great to see you guys there. We had an incredible presentation. I'm kind of exhausted from it. It's probably why I'm sitting here and recording this intro on my phone instead of doing it the way I've done it before. But I want to make sure to tell you a little bit of the amazing time we had there. We had incredible talks. We had the guys from Fuse Effects come by, and Encore Effects, and Digital Domain, and No Zone. Square Enix was really great. We had the director of Final Fantasy 15 talk for a little bit. That was really cool. Pixamundo was there. Blur, Atomic Fiction, and Scanline. We even showed our new reel, which will be probably coming up online real soon, so keep an eye out for that, and you guys can check that out. But it was really, really cool to have everyone there. I also managed to get a couple of podcasts in. I got one with Martin Ented from IKEA, and I've known him for years. He's a really, really great. I really wanted to be able to do a podcast with him for a long, long time. It's really talk about, you know, the sort of cool stuff they're doing at IKEA in terms of their 3D stuff and the VR and AR stuff. Also did one with the No Zone guys and talk about their sort of 6 degrees of freedom pre-rendered VR stuff called Present. So I'm sure there's a lot of questions about that, so we're able to get that in there too, which was really great. So it was a lot of fun to do that. Anyway, back to Michael. Michael Wilkin, as I said, is the director of 3D over at Saatchi & Saatchi 3D. Saatchi & Saatchi, if you guys don't know, is one of the biggest advertising agencies in the world, if not the biggest. I don't really know the numbers, but I know they're very big and very well known. And so it was really kind of cool to see what he was able to do over there and talk about it. They are located in Torrance, across the street from the Toyota headquarters, and that's no accident. Basically, Michael does a lot of work in CG cars, and they manage sort of a virtual garage there, and they know a lot about lighting cars, which is how I knew him from years and years ago, back when I was doing car commercials over at Sway and at Method. There's a lot of work that goes into cars. It is a true specialty that a lot of people don't realize in terms of understanding trim packages and how to light a car correctly from exterior to interior, and in terms of understanding what the different things that you need to be considering when you're looking at cars and how do you get approvals on things. So it's a really interesting thing. And for those of you who've ever done a car commercial, this is something very familiar to you. But if you've never done a car commercial, this may be something of interest to you, so you realize how different working in cars actually is. So it really was a lot of fun, and thanks so much to Michael to come by and be able to share his knowledge with us and be able to see what's going on. Also really cool to see that they're doing a lot of GPU rendering, including using a VCA, so lots of great stuff. All right, guys, so thank Michael so much for doing this, and we will see you later. Thanks, guys.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passé. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
So I think the first time that you and I met was when I was at Sway.
Yeah, yeah. I totally knew who you were because our team had I had learned V-Ray off a lot of the tutorials that you had done.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh,
so like the global illumination for Gnomon. And we loved V-Ray, but I think we switched over to MentalRite because we wanted to use Maya for a while.
Right.
But yeah, so all of our guys knew exactly who you were. And Mark Glazer comes in and you come in and it's like, is that Chris Nichols?
Yeah, because I just did those DVDs just before going to Sway.
Yeah.
And you were at Saatchi at the time, right?
Yeah, I was at Saatchi.
Okay.
Yeah.
How long have you been there?
I've been there for 10 years.
Really?
10 long years. It's and crazy. That's like an eternity in ad agency years.
That is.
Yeah.
So, but this, what's interesting about it is that, what did you do the 3D department there to kind of start it?
Yeah, yeah. So I was a creative.
Sure.
I came from design and I always geeked out about doing my own 3D, you know, like usually for design and motion graphics and stuff like that. Uh-huh. And I started geeking out about car renders.
Okay.
And, I was kind of obsessing about doing car renders on my own projects.
Yep.
And eventually they're just like, we need to make a business out of this. And Toyota's really interested in, you know, using their CAD data for that. So I just slowly started kind of building up a department around it.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
But that's, okay, so you guys are based in Torrance, literally across the street from Toyota, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So your relationship with those guys is pretty strong.
It's right? really strong.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so how does that work? How does it work that a advertising agency has a 3D department? Do you still do posts or what do you use that for?
Yeah. So, I mean, there's kind of a lot of different parts of the 3D department now because we've gotten a little more specialized in different areas. But, mm-hmm. you know, one of the first things that we did is made sure that we had a handhold on how to use the data. And we have a team of producers that will vendor out, but we've now got a very large production capability in-house.
Okay.
So we're doing a lot of images, a lot of animations in-house as well.
Right. I remember there was a big thing about sort of running footage in a lot of ways, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So a lot of people may not necessarily I know because I've done a ton of car commercials. You know, I was at Sway. That's kind of was our bread and butter. But explain to people what, like, running footage is and what that is.
Well, I mean, there's in the abstract, it's just animation of, you know, or footage of a car driving down the road.
Right.
But there's different kind of aspects when you really get deep into automotive advertising.
Uh-huh.
There's running footage that gets shot long form that gets used for a lot of different things in terms of, including like the retail commercials you might see.
Sure.
On television. And then there's also running footage that may happen for a big 10-pole, 30-second spot.
Right.
But I think generally when we talk about running footage, it tends to be, when we talk about it as a project, mm-hmm. it tends to be where you're shooting maybe the entire fleet of vehicles for a model year.
Yeah.
You're shooting the vehicles in a number of different scenarios.
Locations, et cetera.
And now, I mean, running footage just becomes kind of along for the project because a lot of that stuff is happening 3D as well. So.
Right. And so you guys have made sort of a 3D version of this, so you want to see turntables of cars, you want to put in a commercial,
yeah.
And so
yeah,
and people can use this for all kinds of stuff, right?
Oh yeah, and I think what we've really found is certainly there's some confidence people have in shooting things, you know, just doing a physical shoot,
mm-hmm.
But when you do it 3D, you not only get the grade and the model that you're you know you originally start with,
yep.
but it's you can develop tools and really build systems. So over time, it's all product variations.
Yeah.
And when you're looking at a manufacturer like Toyota, for instance, you could easily count 100,000, not even get into accessories, different ways you could put vehicles together.
So configure them different ways, different colors, different trim packages.
Yeah. Different trims, wheels. Different packages, different wheels. And chances are, and this is just talking about U.S. market,
yep.
but chances are there are tens of thousands for most of those vehicles and different vehicles you can actually make out of the parts that are valid that compose all the vehicles that you could buy.
Right. And so what's interesting to me, I mean, I remember, you know, when we're working on a commercial, you always used to, I sort of learned this process. It's like, there's actually a huge variations of markets that you can sell these packages to, right? So you can have a national spot, which is aired everywhere in the United States. And it's like, this is the latest Camry or whatever, right?
Yeah.
And boom, it's like, whoa. Or you can have your local area, like Southern California dealerships having a special, you know, for Christmas or whatever. And they'll do a package to sell that stuff.
Yeah.
Or down to even a dealership could buy its own little packages, right?
Exactly. And that's one of the things that we're doing a lot more of now is making sure that that we create big, varied asset packages. So if, whether you're talking about the national advertising or the local dealers,
right.
they have a huge pool of assets they can choose from when they uh-huh. want to, they could, you know, market something that's really specific to what they're trying to sell.
Right. I remember ages ago, I was looking at I'm going to request to create one of these giant packages, right? And
yeah.
these things, and I said, this is hours of rendering.
Like, oh yeah,
and
yeah.
the final, not in terms of how to render it. I'm talking about once it's all rendered, like if you just looked at everything we just rendered, it'd probably be like 4 hours of footage that we had created all CG, right?
Oh, yeah, easily.
Yeah. And so you guys still create that in-house now more?
More and more we're creating that stuff in-house.
That's amazing.
Like a lot of the really emotional spots and stuff like that, we try to find the best vendor we possibly can.
Sure.
But when we can... we're getting really good at the systematic stuff and the stuff that's fleet-wide in-house. So,
yeah. And you guys manage these assets too. So you know exactly what package to give, what is like, you're going to use this, you know, this Camry or whatever. And
Yeah. And that's one of the things that I think folks like working with us from that standpoint, because when we're producing, you know, when our producers farm out a job, yeah, you don't have to guess whether you're getting data that's from CAD, if you're getting a pile of parts or you're actually going to get a product accurate Maya file, you know?
Right. Yeah. And so you give out your assets to people then? So you give them out to the agency or the VFX places that would possibly do your commercials?
Yeah. If they're approved for security and all that, then we make sure they get whatever they need for the production.
And what's the process of translating from CAD to workable meshes? Do you guys do that as well?
Yeah. So we do it when it's needed. Toyota has some really amazing people.
Yep.
That do a lot of the heavy lifting, but so
they do some of that themselves.
They do some of it themselves, but there's always stuff that changes on the local level.
Okay.
And depending on how early you're talking about doing the production, sometimes you have to do the CAD tessellation and really prep the data in a way that's usable for the production. So.
Yeah. So this was always a challenge. So for people that car stuff is it's its own industry, as we were just discussing right now. You can figure out, you know, there's visual effects and then just car commercial itself is its own industry, and there are places out there, as you know, that are specialists in
it's
that
its
area.
Own little world. Yeah.
Yep. And so here are some of the challenges, just so that people understand, and you can jump in anytime, but so people understand, is like, first of all, most of this data used to be, you'd either have two choices if you're going to get a CG car. You would either scan an existing car, mm-hmm. where you'd do different things. You could either laser scan it, or there was a really great group, I forgot their name, but they were out of Utah, and they would plot scan.
Yeah, I remember those guys. Oh, I can't forget the name offhand.
They were
great. We used them all the time.
Yeah, and they were really cool. And so they would plot scan the car, right? And they would basically literally take pieces of tape and put it on the body panels,
the car.
And they would create what would eventually be the final tessellation, and then they would plot scan it, and they would create it, and they did they were incredibly fast considering how manual the process was.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, and everything was in quads, and people loved that.
Yeah,
but we used them for years and years, but eventually, we've really gotten to the point where that from CAD process, there's so many advantages.
Right.
And when you get into things like headlights and taillights and the really defined reflective areas, like there's nothing that beats actually having engineer accurate data.
Absolutely. So this was so Daniel Buck and I think you remember Daniel. He was one of my partner in arms on a lot of these car things. He knew a lot about it. But we always kind of liked then things have changed, obviously. It was a long time ago. We always liked the scan data for the body panels, but the CAD data for the headlights and stuff like that.
Right, right.
Because the headlights are like the eyes of the car. They're the most important part when you're looking at a car commercial, right? And so we would reflect all the actual intricacies of it, right? So we would see all the refraction and glows that are going on inside there. You wouldn't just have a picture. But the body panels had imperfections, slight imperfections when you would scan them, which made them feel a little more real. And sometimes the CAD data was too perfect and it would look a little not as real.
Yeah. And there's still some areas where CAD data is too perfect. And, you know, another area would be like the seats.
Oh, right.
You know, so.
So you still sculpt the seats.
Yeah. Even if we get completely accurate data, it's going to look hard and it's going to look too perfect. So you have to go in and really do some manual work on all that stuff.
Do you guys do it in ZBrush or something like that?
Yeah. ZBrush or Mudbox,
Seems to be the thing of choice. Yeah, yeah. Just sculpting the wrinkles and putting the stitching in to look, you know, and it's interesting.
Yeah. But yeah, there's a difference between engineering accurate and manufactured accurate.
Right.
So you need to fill in those gaps. And there's things like orange peel that you see in paint and all those little fine details. And if you don't get those right, then someone just feels it just feels fake to people.
Yep.
Of course, you almost kind of need to get it you almost need to get it accurate first, and then people might take them out to make the car look a little more perfect.
But, yep.
But you need to be able to first make it real, and then convince people it's real, and then you might polish it up after that.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So another thing that was a big challenge is, okay, once you've got your car and you've gone through the different process of getting there, you had a specific car, and there's always a few gaps or miscommunications. I'm sure that's gotten a lot better, specifically with a team like you, but there was those you'd have to do the render and give that to a product specialist to identify, yep. No, that's the wrong trim. No, these wheels are not correct. That looks like the keyhole looks like it's in the wrong position, like random things like that that you would find, right?
Yeah, and our guys have gotten really good at trying to fill in. I mean, and that's one of the benefits to us in doing some of the work ourselves.
Yeah.
And especially doing things like configurators ourselves, because we have to get everything right.
Yeah.
So that now when we hand off data to productions, chances are that it's not going to be like, oh, that's the wrong wheel.
No, exactly.
Which is actually used to be incredibly common.
So common.
Yeah.
So common. And then the other things are like the license plate. What does the license plate look like? And, of course, you have to make these fake license plates that are – you have to have a license plate on there because it can't not have one, but you can't have a specific. So you make a license plate that's actually the same color as the paint of the car.
Yep.
And then you do all these random things, and then you'd have to have – a person driving the car, but you can't really recognize the person, so you make them all dark, and you do something like that to make that work. And then and then you have to figure out, like, does these have daytime running lights or no daytime running lights? Is this airing in Canada? Because Canada, all cars have to have daytime running lights.
Yep. Yep.
Like, these are all these rules that would happen. It was really, really fascinating to me.
Yeah, and I think that's it can be really a scope issue if those rules come into play after the renders have done and people are in the final finish and it's like, oh, this is not right.
Yeah.
So we try to avoid that as much as possible now.
But it's really cool. And the fact that you guys are right next to Toyota must be really helpful. I guess you guys have spent tons of meetings looking over their latest designs and everything else.
Yeah. And we've been really fortunate. I mean, since we kind of got involved with them in the early days too, mm-hmm. like there's some nice strong contacts that we have.
Sure.
Both on kind of the manufacturing end and the people who prepare the data.
Right.
But there's also things that change for the local market.
Right.
Very close up until the vehicle is actually released. So that communication is actually important too.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you guys, does that part of the Scion stuff as well, or?
Well, it used to be.
Really?
Yeah. So I think there's certainly some changes going on with Scion right now. So.
Okay.
But yeah, it's a Scion, Toyota, Lexus. They're all part of Toyota.
The same package. Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you remember? And I don't know how much we can talk about it, but were you part of that thing? I was at Sway, and it was a crazy commercial that we did, and it was for a Corolla that was done with a miniature shoot. Do you remember that one?
Vaguely, it's been a long time, but
and I want to say this was probably like 7 years ago or something like that.
Yeah,
and we did this crazy long commercial. It was actually like 8 minutes worth of stuff for a 30-second commercial.
Yeah,
and it was all these different features that we were doing.
Yeah,
and they were going to be able to splice together different commercials depending on which area of the country they were going to make it for.
Yeah.
So, this country cares about Bluetooth. This part of the country doesn't care about Bluetooth. This country cares about, CD players or MP3 player or whatever. Like, so it was all divided up.
It sounds like it was a little ahead of its time almost.
It was. Yeah. And so we created, and it was all shot. We did it in combination with Buck. Do you remember Buck?
Yeah, I remember Buck. Yeah.
And so Buck did a lot of design work, and we did all the CG car stuff, right?
Right.
And we worked together, and it was a long, long job, and we worked for crazy, crazy amount of time on it, and it was like, okay, great, and we were very proud of it. And then right as that happened, it was, I guess, some big oil crisis happened.
Okay.
And they scrapped the entire commercial, and they said, nope, and they just showed running footage and just talked about how they get good miles to the gallon, and that was it.
Oh, wow. Yeah, so, I wasn't – if I vaguely remember something like that, but I don't know if I was very close to it.
So. I mean, it's a logical decision. He's like, it's like you just spend millions of dollars on this commercial.
Yeah.
I don't know how much it actually was. That bid was a long time ago. But we worked, and we worked through Christmas. It was crazy. But yeah, those things happen. Yeah.
But that's a really cool way of looking at things. And I think we're seeing that more and more where, data-driven marketing has become a much bigger thing mm-hmm. for advertising in general.
Yeah.
The content is becoming much more varied. Right. And you're having the logic behind what ads and what information, what images get served to what person is becoming much, much more robust.
And you can almost do that on a personal level now on the internet, right?
Oh, absolutely you can.
It's like, we're going to configure a commercial for that person.
Yeah, we have a team within Saatchi that's really amazing. They're just devoted just to doing stuff like that.
Wow.
So so we're seeing on the content end where stuff like that is becoming incredibly relevant.
Yeah.
Because you want to be able to create the variety of content so you can serve people, ads and product that are relevant to them.
Yeah. This is such good stuff. I don't know. It's kind of fascinating. Part of me was tired of car commercials. I was doing so many car commercials. I wanted to do something different. And then, of course, when I went on to Tron, I went on to Light Bike Sequence, which is a big car commercial.
Yeah. Which was amazing, by the way. I love that.
But there is something kind of interesting about doing doing car commercials. I remember working with Simon Needham, who was at one of the founders of The Attic.
Yeah, I've met Simon.
Yeah, he's a super, super amazing creative guy. Yeah. Right. I mean, he created some very, very creative sign commercials that were very graphic design oriented. Right?
Yeah. Oh, some of the early Attic designs are just amazing. If you go turn back the clock to some of the aesthetics of what they're doing and just the creativity in them was amazing.
And we created these commercials. It was back at Method, where the whole point of the Scion is how customizable it could be.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it was about these cars moving, but they would constantly change to other trim packages.
Yeah.
So we had to create probably about 30 or 60 different versions of a car.
Yeah.
And then it would constantly change, and they would do that work, and then I was, going through the process of, this is this trim package. This just got the what's it, TRD?
TRD?
Yeah. See, I even remember the TRD packages that were going. He goes, this is good. You guys, you know that dialogue. Because once you get that dialogue of understanding the packages, it's different. Yeah. You sort of become ingrained in that car world.
Well, what's kind of interesting too, and for us focusing on knowing that we're focusing on this stuff year after year.
Yeah.
And we, it's a pretty good chance we're going to be doing something like that next year. So we can develop more things in pipeline to deal with that.
Yep.
But increasingly, when we create an asset, it's for everything that can roll off the factory floor.
Right.
Right. So all trims, all packages, all colors, all grades, all accessory combinations.
Yep.
We were handling all of that. Yeah. And it's kind of a world in two of itself getting all that stuff right. So.
Now, are you guys dealing all with the United States mostly, or a little bit on the world market?
Bit on the world market. Okay. Yeah.
And so, how long has Saatchi been having a relationship with Toyota? Obviously, enough. It's not a coincidence you guys are across the street from Toyota.
I couldn't even tell you when we started.
Right.
But I think it's probably the 60s or 70s.
Oh, really? Okay. Yeah. Yeah. And we should also note that Saatchi is one of the biggest advertising agencies in the world.
We have about 120 offices worldwide.
Okay.
And that's just the official Saatchi brand, not even owned properties, but it's a very large advertising agency network.
Yeah. And you deal with big, big customers like Toyota.
big customers, yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's awesome. I just find that fascinating. But I guess we should really talk about some of the new things you guys have been doing, because you guys have been doing some really cutting edge things where you guys want to be able to turn around stuff really quickly and looking at new ways of doing things. So tell people a little bit about that.
Well, I mean, I think that kind of the way we're focusing on things in general is we want to master the virtual representation of our client's product and the brand elements that are associated with them.
Yep.
So both for kind of traditional content creation and we're getting excited about VR and AR as well.
Mm-hmm.
We're trying to really kind of leverage the scope of what we're doing on productions and figuring out how we can kind of multiply the different assets that we have
and
new combinations in new ways. So one of the things that we were talking about at GTC that I think you may have seen for presentation is increasingly when we're going out and doing photo shoots or partnering with productions, or even if we're just doing a CG production, we'll go out and We're scanning environments. We're capturing all the information that we need to to create a completely photorealistic representation, and then we're doing just as detailed of a build as we can in those environments. Mm-hmm. So when we're talking about being able to configure product, well, we're increasingly be able to configure environments too, and we're trying to develop the pipeline as efficiently as possible, so it's not as manual of a process every time we're trying to integrate those variants or do a virtual set or do a new animation.
We're
able to kind of leverage all of these assets that we're gathering to be able to really create asset packages for people. So that's kind of part of it. Certainly, we're focusing on a lot of little tools for pipeline and just automating things over time for the general asset pools that we're doing for running footage. And for, you'll see things for automotive. One of the big things for them is the build-in price on their website. But that those productions for us are actually driving all the assets we're creating in other areas. So we definitely want to increasingly not just make an asset for one grade of one vehicle, but if we're going to the trouble of creating a beautiful photoreal asset of a vehicle in an environment, we want that to be to vary to all the product combinations you could have. And finally, there's a lot of new areas, and we're kind of looking to leverage our production and do some smart things when it comes to VR and AR as well. So we're putting a good amount of R&D into those areas. And I think some of the things that we're doing for productions as well as for virtual locations are kind of dovetailing nicely into that effort as well.
Well, that's cool. And then one of the things, obviously, you were presenting at GTC is your use of the VCA and how you guys are doing things on GPU.
Yeah, we love the GPU acceleration and for process. I think that one of the things that we found, certainly within an agency, we want to make our creative directors and art directors feel comfortable with the process and make it feel more like what they're used to. And I think for very good reason. I mean, they're making a lot of decisions very quickly on the when they're in
a physical shoot. Yeah, they don't have time to wait to see changes.
Yeah, and they don't want to imagine, what the next round is going to look like and have someone interpret it and then see it in a still and then figure out it doesn't feel right to them. So what we really like about NVIDIA VCA, which is like a really cool GPU cluster box.
It's got 8 GPUs in there. It's pretty fast.
And it works
pretty loud too. And
it works really well with RT. So I think that what we like is not having to create a whole new system of, write some new shaders and hope everything is going to look as accurate as the CPU renders in the end. We're doing a previs and we're just, throwing a bunch of GPUs at it. And then when we're doing lighting, we can do it interactively with the creative directors and art directors. Like, move this light a little over here.
And then it resolves really quickly and they can see their, they can see what's going on.
They can see what's going on. And that is, especially for doing something like lighting interiors.
It's very hard to light an interior.
And, I mean, they have to be perfect. You have to have the light just in this right place to show off this dial and the shifter, the IP. Like, there's an art to it. And, you don't want it to be guesswork and you don't want it to be on the nth round and find out that people still aren't happy with the way you lit things. So you can... When you're doing the real time stuff, you can go through 20 rounds in one sitting because you're making those decisions with the creative director really quickly.
It saves you a ton of time.
So
that's cool. And so you guys use the GPU stuff to obviously to art direct and do those things, and then you guys just translate that right back to your CPU farm when you need to. Is that what you do?
Yeah.
So that's kind of cool. You have the versatility of doing CPU and GPU and using the same asset, right?
Oh yeah, that's huge. And we don't want to, and I think that's the thing is like there's so much value in not having to kind of recreate your shaders and. And rejigger things so you can have real time. And that's what I really love because we're, our pipeline's V-Ray. So with RT, we can throw things onto a GPU and get a much faster result. And then if we want to, we want a few features that are still on CPU, we can use a render form for that.
So so what are you guys using mainly as your 3D package? You're using Maya, but I heard you guys are using a little bit of Katana or like toying with it.
Well, we're toying with it. And I think
I think that's a really interesting, because you would never think of car design or manufacturing as using Katana. Katana seems very geared towards production animation or production VFX.
I think that what interests us, and we use Nuke really heavily, but what we really like about those products is increasingly, we actually are really big on pipeline.
Of course. And, well, you have to be, you have so many configurations.
Yeah. Yeah. So, so, and we're really big on variance, and we're really, you know, big on having things not be linear in terms of, you know, in terms of what our workflow is like.
Okay.
So, meaning like, you know, we want it to be modular. Mm-hmm. So, so those tools are really intriguing, and Nuke's really done wonders for us in terms of, you know, like if we were trying to do some sort of, you know, like After Effects based compositing or something like that, I think we would tear our hair out right now.
Yeah, well, Nuke, node-based for a win, node-based, right? I mean, so node-based stuff allows you to just have a cluster here, and then you make a switch and you go to the next cluster or whatever you need to do to configure the car or whatever else you're doing, right?
Yeah.
But I really, really think it's interesting that you guys are also based in Katana, because I guess Katana, you can just have all these assets and you just swap them out, right? And
then
that allows your car to configure itself.
Yeah, and it's early exploration for us, but, but that's really intriguing to us, is like, you know, with all the things that we've been talking about, the more we can make our workflow additive and think about things in terms of, like, we want to add this location to this product variant and have it work for everything across.
Okay.
Doing node-based is really an interesting way to go.
Yeah. Well, I think that's really interesting to sort of just basically have these it's a database, right, really?
Yeah.
So how do you guys manage all those databases? How do you have people that are specifically geared towards managing all these trims and knowledge? And
have a virtual garage team.
A virtual garage team. Yeah.
And those guys are great. They basically... you know, they make sure that they know not only what's coming out of Japan, but you know, any local variants that are happening. They're just masters of you know, how everything comes.
How big is your team?
35 people right now.
Really?
Yeah.
That's a substantial studio.
Yeah. Yeah. Within Saatchi. So Saatchi, even the LA office alone is 600 people, I think.
Right. Close to it.
But yeah. Yeah. And we kind of shrink and grow based on season and stuff like that. But, it's been growing quite a bit.
That's really cool. That's really cool. So what you mentioned briefly the VR and AR stuff, right?
Yeah.
We've obviously had discussion about VR quite a bit. Both just honestly just meaning it as a way to look at where it makes sense and where it's not necessarily making sense.
Yeah, and there's a lot of buzz, and I think there's places where it's being used where it won't make a lot of sense.
Sometimes they're just trying to shoehorn it into a system that doesn't make any sense, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But let's look at this as the idea of car design or art direction or those type of things.
Right. So process.
The process, right? Yeah. Because, for example, we have a bunch of people that we talk to that are architects, and for architects, it's just so logical, because the whole point of VR is to take you to a place that doesn't exist. And that's what architects are doing. They're designing those spaces. So you can look around, you can see things in real scale, et cetera. Tell me about your feeling about, you know, you can be as candid as you want, but about how VR and car design process, marketing, how those worlds work, and where do you see that combination working?
Well, I mean, you probably look at it in three ways. There's the process of actually creating content or designing the product.
Okay.
Right.
More so, direct marketing.
Or actually, yeah, more how we go about creating content.
Okay.
Right. So I think that there's going to be a lot of utility probably on the manufacturing end, because they spend a lot of money on things like power walls and anything to kind of visualize what they're doing.
Okay.
So I could imagine there's going to be some use from the actual manufacturers.
Okay.
And using that along with a lot of other tools, and they'll probably still do clay and all that sort of thing. But
do you think they still use clay? Do you think that VR is kind of a way to start replace, because clay is expensive.
Yeah.
Right.
I think that, yeah, as people get more used to it, they'll get enough benefit out of it that it probably will become less prevalent. Yeah,
just for people who. I'm
armchairing, because I don't design cars.
No, of course not, yeah. Of course not. But no, and I've certainly, yeah, like you said, you're armchairing. But just so people know what I'm talking about, when you, and you've seen it a million times, ironically, in car commercials, they design cars and they would make clay models, different scales, up to full scale clay models of the car, and this is how they would look at the form and go, make decisions on how it would be.
Yeah.
Very expensive, very complicated, and now they're trying to replace it with virtual stuff, right?
Well, and I think the better it gets, once the utility gets to a point that's as good as experience, then sure, why not?
Sure.
Yeah, and there's things that you can get from that, and there's certain things that you can figure out in that, like color, and you know, doing quick variations and changing things on a large scale and being able to go back. That just like it works for us in digital content, I think it'll work for them as well. But obviously, it needs to get a little bit better.
And you can compare and contrast things. So, but do you think that the idea? I mean, one of the biggest advantage of VR is the idea of scale, right?
So, and it's, you know, we've done some experiments, and it's just there are things that you can get from a photograph. There's things that you can get from a movie, and there's things that you can only understand from experiencing it.
Okay.
And you know, for instance, you get inside a car interior, and you're in VR car interior. You can understand pretty well. How visible things are, you know, which is a big thing. If you're going to buy a car,
I can't see that dial.
or you know, what does it look like when you look over your shoulder? Do you feel like you can really see things well when you're driving?
And so,
how big it is. There's you can get a sense of like that in VR that you cannot get a sense of any other way other than actually being there.
Interesting.
So I think it's going to be really valuable in the marketing space, for not only for automotive, but for a lot of other products that may be probably even more valuable for products that you're not going to, it's not such a large purchase point that you need to experience them before you buy them.
Okay.
Right. Going back to workflow, I would love to have eventually VR workflow for 3D and kind of what we're doing. And I can imagine using it for Prevus. So, obviously the interface needs to get designed by the people who do that.
And
things need to get a little bit better.
Okay.
Certainly for when you're
Do you think some of the weak points are right now?
Well, certainly for the packages, nothing has really been designed for workflow other than like Unreal Engine is starting to do like an editor where you can, when you're designing it on Unreal Engine, you can actually try to work in VR. I think these things need to be refined, and if you're doing them in a traditional 3D package, obviously that would need to be refined as well. But the other big bottleneck is just the hardware.
Well, you know what? I don't know if you saw what Vlado did, right?
No,
Vlado
I didn't.
Showed at EUE. He showed a cube map, a viewer that goes directly to the Oculus.
Oh yeah.
So you create a stereo cube maps, right? So cube maps are 6x1 cube map is where it's six sides of a cube.
Yeah.
Okay. And you do a stereo version of it, so you basically have a full stereo 360. It's a still, but it's a 360 view, and it works great on.
So it works like VR video,
VR video, except it's very high, much better quality. I can show you some examples.
Yeah, I'd love to see it.
The thing is, you have to render it, et cetera, and then you can look at it. But what he's done is he took that frame buffer and piped it directly into a frame buffer that goes into the Oculus. In V-Ray RT.
Okay.
So as you're looking things in V-Ray RT, and if you're using a VCA, that's awesome, right?
Yeah.
you can move a light and like, oh yeah, I can see that dial better, and it'll be a VR experience for you or whatever.
Right, yeah, so that I would be really interested. I've been interested in saw a few examples of light field in VR, which are really cool.
Yes.
But certainly if there's going to be a place for doing things in Engine,
right,
and doing that real time simulation, and there's some things you're probably only going to be able to do that way in the short term.
Yep.
But anything that kind of bridges the gap between the quality and the process that you have for really high fidelity rendering, and what you're going to get out of middleware, that's really exciting stuff.
Yeah. Well, I've had this discussion before because there's been a lot of people that have been saying real time rendering is going to kill offline rendering. And they're right. They are absolutely right to say that. But that's the wrong question. Because the question is, will rasterized rendering kill ray tracing? And that's absolutely not true. Ray tracing has killed rasterized rendering before, and it'll kill it again. Because the ultimate goal of real time is to be ray tracing.
They
want to do that, right? So ray tracing will eventually be inside the packages. Because you know it yourself. You know, when you're looking at a car interior, rasterization is only going to get you so far, right?
Oh, and car paint and things like that.
Yeah.
Like if you can't ray trace, there's always going to be some kind of compromise.
Yeah, exactly.
I think that the ultimate goal of VR is to feel like you're actually experiencing that thing.
Yep.
Or you're there.
Yeah.
And so the more realistic it can get.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. So you feel, so most of the benefit you're seeing from VR is going to be car interior, I'm assuming, right? You don't see like yourself walking around a car?
Oh, absolutely.
You do?
I think you've of course used the Vive.
Yeah, of course.
And that's, I think you get some sense that, you know, from the exteriors as well.
Yeah.
So I think that it has valuable for exteriors and interiors and maybe for some more emotional content too.
It's true. It's true. I don't know. There's something about touching a car a little bit, and that's little bit that's going to be missing.
Well, yeah, and I think that you probably for cars specifically, you may not look at it as only like for lower price point products, you might kind of look at, okay, well, maybe I don't want to buy this. I can just look at this thing in VR and I decide to order the toaster on Amazon.
Okay.
Right. So there's probably quite a lot of people that are going to really want to experience the real thing before they make that final decision. Yeah.
Yeah. It's true. I'm just sort of fascinated. But what about AR? Where do you see the AR playing in?
I think they all have their value. And I think that for both, the future is bright. The question is how close is the real utility of the future?
Yeah.
You know, when is it going to go from, wow, this is really cool,
right,
to I need to use this every day for this reason? But augmented reality, obviously, that there's some things that are really nice about it in that you can be in the space that you're in. You don't have to leave that space.
I would almost think that like for an interior of a car, a VR experience would be key. But for an exterior of a car, an AR experience would be good because then you can just walk around see you in your driveway. Yep.
I think the thing for AR obviously is, okay, what form factors are really going to take hold and what's the processing power behind those?
Uh-huh.
You know, because like right now you can, AR is big on phones.
Sure.
They're using it on Google Glass, and HoloLens is really cool, of course.
Yeah. I did a whole thing with Sally Slade. She came here with her HoloLens. That was the first time I experienced it. I was like, this is crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. So long as you're looking straightforward, it actually does an amazing job of kind of tracking things.
Yeah.
But you know, I think that depending on how complex of a scene or a thing that you're trying to show, you're going to have to dumb things down a little bit if you want it to run on whatever device you're talking about.
Sure.
So if you're talking about something mobile that you're walking around and AR has utility because it's giving you in context of the environment that you're already in, that's kind of one application. If it's running off a PC, then I think that you're going to develop things in a different way and you're going to do maybe more high-end visualization, real-time visualization.
Okay.
But I think one of the real values of AR is just you can add the information and make it contextual to what you're seeing right then and there.
Right. Okay, well, what do you think are some of the future trends now? I mean, obviously, when we were doing these things, car commercials, when I was doing it back at Sway, car commercials were huge. It's just, you know, why one of the reasons Sway became successful.
Yeah.
But what do you see some of the trends in car commercials now? What's going on? What's changed in the last 7 years?
Well, I think that the content has gotten more digital.
More digital. So much more online.
Much more online. It's gotten, and I think we're kind of touching this on this already, it's gotten much more, the content is becoming much more varied and much more targeted to consumers.
Mm.
So there are those big tentpole commercials
and
concepts and brand statements that are being made, but they're also being leveraged in different ways. So you're giving customers, you're micro-targeting customers based on what you know about them and what they're interested in. So you're making the ads much more relevant to them. So I think where that relates to 3D is when you can vary the content and really kind of use some of the advantages of CG.
Okay.
When you're talking about traditional media or images and movies and things in that order,
right?
It's being served. You want to be able to serve thousands to hundreds of thousands of variations.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's the thing. It's like, I guess, creating it on the fly and I guess almost dynamically, right?
Yeah, while maintaining the quality.
Right.
Right. So I think that's one of the big trends that you're seeing is just taking kind of starting to leverage the strengths of 3D not only to do fantastical things, but to do things that where you would never know the difference, but you're doing it for you know, just a huge amount of variety.
And what do you think has happened that allowed that quality to get to the point where you feel comfortable in that? Like, what were some of the big changes that made that quality happen?
Well, I mean, certainly people have gotten better at it. The rendering has gotten so much better.
Sure.
You know, just Moore's Law stuff has helped.
So right, so just computers are faster, so you can create more content.
Then
right?
They keep on getting faster. Mm-hmm. So I think that all those things are kind of coming together, and I think they just things are just getting more mature. So people are no longer thinking about automotive advertising and 3D rendering as like, okay, we're going to do this one project and it's going to be great, and then we'll figure out the next project. It's like I think people are really focusing in on how do we do this in a smart way, and thinking about things as like a multi-year effort as opposed to as just one and done.
And you mentioned people are getting better at it, because that's always been a thing in the early days of car commercials. You can always tell they're CG because, and this is one of the things, it was the simplest thing. They always got the clear coat wrong, right?
Yeah.
The clear coat was always way too shiny, and it looked like a Christmas ball, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, that was one of the, that's probably when I started saying things like everything has Fresnel, and I was getting really upset about those things. It's because the Fresnel of the clear coat is the critical part of what makes a car look the right kind of shiny, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And so the car paint is actually one of you've got to have one person, at least one person in the office that's really good at car paint. Oh,
you have to have people that obsess over those things, and then
right.
and then you there's the getting a car looking realistic aspect of it.
Right.
But I think what we've found and what we've really benefited over the years is there's a lot of knowledge in the photographers and in the the art directors that are directing this stuff every day, and what happens after you shoot the car or how you light that car.
Mm-hmm.
I think in the early days, people got excited that the car just looked real.
Sure.
And it might look real, but it didn't necessarily look good.
Yeah.
Or people would try to make things look like a retouched photo, but they wouldn't quite get it.
Right.
And people would always want to go back to making it look real, and then they want to retouch it to make it look good.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that really listening to the people that direct this stuff every day.
Car photographers,
car art directors,
mm-hmm.
and understanding that their point of view is incredibly valid and we need to figure it out.
Yeah.
I think that's made our team better over time, and we've gotten, and I think that the people that do this for the vendors that do this for a living, they're getting better at it as well.
So that's an interesting point, because I think, you know, just like we mentioned in the CG world, that this is a specialty of CG. Car CG is a specialty that really is highly focused. At the same time, on the practical side of things, car photographers and car DPs are also specialists, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
A car is lit actually with very few lights, but it's usually just one big ass Fisher light or something like that.
Yeah, the big Fisher box on top.
And so it's a huge white area light, to put it in the V-Ray terms, right?
Yeah.
And it's on top, and the whole point of it is to catch a reflection on the car where you can see the shape, right? So the shape of the car is critical.
And depending on the car, there might be things that there's a feature of a car that people just really want to focus on,
mm-hmm.
and or that's testing well.
Yep.
And they'll subtly change things just a little bit just to get that reflection just right, just perfect.
Yeah. And so one of the things, and anyone who's listening, when you're driving home or doing whatever and you go look at a car, every single car out there has a point near the door handles.
Character line.
The character line. Yeah. I used to call it the bone of the car, right?
Yeah.
And it's right near the door handles usually, where the panels of the car go from reflecting upwards to reflecting downwards, right? Mm-hmm. And that's when you look at it, that's where the sky is going to be, because the sky is up and then the ground is down. And so the top of the car, right at that line, which is hyper-designed, if you think about it, it's like this very specific, every car has a very specific character line, as you can, it's called character, right?
Yeah.
And that line is the critical part of what that makes that car look unique.
Yeah.
And it's just a subtle change in direction of the panel lines that creates that character. And so when you're lighting a car, you're lighting it so that that character line, the Fisher light that's on top, it pulls that out, right?
Yeah. Yeah, so, among other things, yeah.
Yeah, but it's really kind of an important thing. So do you guys learn from car photographers? Do they go and do stuff, or?
I think early on we did.
Okay.
But we have art directors and creative directors.
In-house.
In-house.
Right.
That have been shooting cars or been on shoots for decades.
Yeah.
And they have a number of ways they may want to light a vehicle.
Yep.
And a very specific and really specialized knowledge on kind of what they think is going to look for good for that car.
Yeah. Yeah, there was a, well, I remember it was on that Sound commercial with Simon, right?
Yeah.
For some reason, there was still a little bit of a trust issue that the CG car wouldn't necessarily look real.
Oh, absolutely.
Of course.
Absolutely, yeah.
But there was, Simon was like reassuring. He's like, no, we've hired, you know, these are great guys. They used to be at Sway, and now at Method. They're great guys. They're really good.
Yeah.
But to reassure you, and they had, this was a big national spot, so there was some money behind this.
Yeah.
Just to reassure you on this, we are going to hire a DP specialist in car commercial shoots to come in and consult, right?
Oh, and for the big tentpole things, I think that's the right way to go.
Sure.
That's why be safe about it.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so the name of the DP was Dana Christensen.
Do you remember
Dana? I don't know if you know. He's a super nice guy. He's not a CG guy at all, but at the same, he's very respectful of it. And he's like, great, I still have a job. They're using my expertise, even though it's a completely CG commercial. I'm still getting paid to consult on this. And one of the things that Simon told him was, okay, so imagine you have an unlimited budget, but you still can only use things that you can actually acquire, right? So you can't make a 200-foot Fisher box because days don't exist. So you can only make a 70-foot Fisher box or whatever, right?
Yeah. So you don't want to do something that you're never going to see in the real world because it may look off to people even if it's accurate.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. And so we shot all this stuff and he gave us some unbelievable advice that I remember very, very specifically. One was like the spacing of the cars because they were driving, and he wanted that spacing is enough because, and I actually used this exact method on Tron, by the way.
Yeah.
The point when you have a car moving in the dark, right? You don't know how fast it's going because it's dark. So you have no relative speed. So the only way you can know that is seeing the reflections going by in a car, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So you had to space out these Fisher boxes so that you could actually get that speed going. And we used the exact same. We had the same problem on Tron because they're on a big glass surface with practically no horizon line because it was huge. So we put these little lights on them. We called them Trino flows or Tron Kino flows. So. But then another thing that was interesting was one of those classic close-up pictures of a bumper. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's like it's kind of moving along. We're shaking the camera to get that sense of speed, right? And he said, that bumper looks CG because it's too clean.
Yep.
And so what he said, he's like, you know what happens on my shoots? He says, I'm doing a shoot like that and I've got like – craft services or whatever else behind here, and I can see them, and there's nothing that reflection can't hide. So he had us add a bunch of random CG stuff behind the camera just to break up the horizon line so it would look more realistic.
Yeah, and those little things really matter.
They do. You
might even end up taking them out at the end.
Yeah.
But you need to establish that trust.
Right.
And if you're doing a 3D production where folks are used to doing photo shoots year after year,
yeah,
the second you lose that trust, you're going to go round after round after round after round.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So the more you can do to kind of establish those little imperfections, uh-huh, even if you end up taking them out at the end.
Yeah. I mean, it's a little bit like what we were talking about earlier with the plotted cars, right? The reason they work for us is because the panel lines were not exactly the way they were designed in CAD because the manufacturing has slight variances, right?
Yeah.
So you're able to have a little bit different reflection on this panel because it's going to have a slight change of shape. So those are critical to the way that thing looks.
Yeah, but it is, I think what you're saying, it is important. You kind of have to realize that if you're breaking from reality just because you now have these new amazing tools where you can create a 1,000-foot Fisher box, doesn't mean it's a good idea.
No, because that doesn't look real anymore.
It's almost like, you know, it's kind of its own uncanny valley for people.
Yep.
You might not know until someone just sees it and they don't know why it doesn't feel right, but it doesn't feel right to them.
Yeah. I was like, oh, I didn't tell you I made a 1,000-foot Fisher box. Yep. Well, that's really, really cool. What are some of the other future trends you're seeing down the car? What do you think besides, you know, you mentioned obviously the way that things are going digital, things are becoming way more, I guess, targeted is the way we would say it, right?
Yeah.
What are some of the other things you're seeing in terms of technology or what's going to change? Or what are you looking forward to?
Well, I mean, I'm looking forward to, let's see. Well, I can't not talk about virtual reality and augmented reality. Because it's like, yeah, so maybe I'll, but I do think.
But you can continue talking about it.
I'll continue to talk about it. I mean, the thing that's so exciting is, you know, growing up and doing, you know, geeking out over 3D and, mm-hmm. and kind of the world that you work on when you're in an application.
Yep.
It is virtual to a certain extent.
Sure. So, sure. You're looking at this car and you're moving it around. Yeah, you feel like you're manipulating it.
You maybe have to use some of your imagination in terms of what the final render is going to look like. But,
sure.
Or maybe you're working a little bit in real time, but I think that there's something really amazing of transitioning from a medium that is in just kind of what we're used to, which is, you know, a still image or whatever. We just be kind of grown up and become used to that as like that's kind of representing reality.
Sure.
Something that's just much more akin to experience,
mm-hmm.
and what we can do with that.
Interesting.
Right. So I think that's going to get it. It'll probably take a while to mature into okay. areas that are really useful in big business. But when it does, I think it's going to be amazing.
Okay.
On top of that, I think that our workflows, even for creating traditional content, are becoming much more simulation and virtual. There certainly is a comp aspect to it.
Yeah.
And you know, a retouching aspect to everything that we're doing.
Okay.
But I think that the rendering software, the workflow is getting, we're doing more and more in simulation.
In simulation. So, what do you mean by simulation?
Or just in
real-time lighting.
In the render.
Yeah, in the rendering. Okay.
As opposed to doing everything in post afterwards.
Right.
You know, and I think the more we can make that, you know, I think we can start leveraging one thing to a next. So it's like, oh, you have these virtual sets. You have this pipeline where you have a virtual product.
Yep.
Maybe there's new brand elements that come into play.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden you can start thinking about that as an ecosystem,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to, oh, we need to get this shot done.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
So I think that to me is really exciting, to start to think about these things as a larger system, as opposed to just trying to be one and done and get done with this individual project.
Right. Okay. Yeah. And I see it. Do you see yourself creating content in VR for marketing? Like, if let's say some guy, you know, that let's say commonplace, everyone has a Vive or an Oculus at
home,
yeah. And they're like, oh yeah, here's all your content, and it's all VR ready, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that, you know, there's a couple of different ways it could go. And one of the easy ways, you know, you could see it having a value pretty soon, mm-hmm. just experiencing things that aren't there.
Sure.
So marketing a product is valuable. There's things I buy on Amazon I wish I had been able to take a little bit better look at yes. before I purchased it. And, you know, big bosses are not as prevalent as they used to be.
Yeah.
So I think.
Well, I know that Lowe's, I think, is creating a whole VR thing.
Yeah.
So that you can see how big something looks or what a bathroom's going to look like.
Oh, and that's really important to
yes.
what you're going to do.
Yeah.
Like, how does that fit on your kitchen table?
Yeah.
Like, how big is that thing?
Yeah. IKEA is probably doing the same thing.
Yeah. And you can measure it and you can get the dimensions, but yep. there's something really amazing about just, you know, putting on your headset and seeing yep. it. So I think that there's going to be value for that. I think the other aspect of it is, as this thing matures a lot more, just on the VR side of things, I do think it can be a even a more emotional experience than long form TV content.
Sure.
Because I think you remember things a little bit different way when you're in VR. I was actually there. I
yeah.
experienced this thing. So, as it matures over time, that then outside of just the pure utility, I think there would be some really amazing ways to reach people.
What do you think is going to have to be the big push for that to happen in VR, right? What you said, as it matures, right? So what is the maturity that it needs to have?
Well, more people need to have it.
Right.
Because I think that, you know, where you see it now is you go to a trade show and people are waiting in line and there's like 30 people
it's
in
the
line.
Worst.
And they put on a sweaty headset.
Yeah.
And it's great because it's new. So people will wait in line and will talk about it afterwards.
I refuse to wait in line for VR content, to be
yeah.
honest, because it's just too long.
Well, once you have a Vive at home, then it's or
it's
Oculus
fine.
At home, then
I will
why?
Do that at home.
Yeah,
because that's the problem, right? It's a one person at a time experience, right? It's a personal thing.
Well, that's not in the short term. You're going to get press, and people will remember it, and they will tweet on it, you know, and
sure.
you'll get buzz on social media, and it'll have its value for that. But I think in the longer term, the real value is at home.
Yeah.
For VR specifically.
Like, okay.
Like AR, it's probably going to be in other places, but you don't want to go someplace to experience something, because if you're going to do that, you'd just go experience the real thing.
Okay.
Right? So, but I think when you have that at home, then all you need to do is put on a headset to get that experience. Yeah. And that's going to be really valuable.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. So the first thing is that everyone has to have a Vive or an Oculus at home.
Not everyone, but enough.
But enough people. It's like saying you have to have an internet connection,
and,
right?
Yeah, and not just the Vive and the Oculus. It's kind of like, you know, I think one of the things when you're developing for VR is what's your target computer? Mm-hmm. What's the graphics card? Because mm-hmm. if you're doing lowest common denominator, the kind of experience you can give people right now is somewhat limited.
You can. But I mean, I still, for example, on the architecture side, and I've used this argument before, I think cardboard is extremely valuable to the architecture.
For some things,
right?
Yeah.
Because it allows it to become way more distribution. It's a file, you know, if you're a designer, an architect, and you want to show your customer their new office or whatever, you can have them walk away with a $5 piece of cardboard, and they can take that on the go using the phone they have in their pocket and say, okay, it's not the best quality, but it'll certainly give you an idea of what I was looking at.
Yeah, and when you're doing it pre-rendered video, then they could get a pretty photorealistic view.
Sure.
They just you just can't lean forward or walk around
right,
and do those
right,
sorts
right.
of things. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. So I think they all have their uses.
Yep.
But I think, you know, the really exciting stuff and the thing that I think makes people go wow in my experience mm-hmm. is when people first tried the Vive.
Yeah. That's really cool because it's that parallax makes a big difference. Yeah. I think that every stage of VR has a value, right?
Yeah.
And the Vive definitely has a value. I think the Oculus has a value as well.
Oh, yeah. Obviously. Yeah.
But I think the Gear VR has a huge value, and then all the way down to the cardboard, they're all kind of there. And I'm just, to be honest, I'm just curious where it's going to go next. Like, what's the next big step that people want to do, or how are they going to push stuff? Right now, we're just barely on the edge of what's capable to do on a graphics card, right? Like, you need a really powerful graphics card just to be able to do basic VR content.
Oh, yeah. You talk about, you know, when we're talking about the automotive.
Right.
You're talking about 15 million polygons for a really detailed vehicle.
Yeah.
Easy.
Easy.
And if you want to push that into VR, you're going to make some compromises in terms of the realism.
Yep.
And then you want an environment and you want things driving or something like that. Yep. You need to limit things even more.
Sure.
So I think that there are things it's going to make sense for in the short term, and there are things it's going to make sense for in the long term.
Yeah.
But the long term future seems really exciting. Yeah.
I'm excited to see it. I'm excited to see it from your perspective, from the content portion, where people get to go in there and experience that car.
Yeah.
Makes sense, right? You know, I'd love to be inside of a new car, or even go to, you know, for example, let's say there's a Detroit Auto Show out there. They're showing off the new cars or whatever. And then you guys could say, like, well, here's a VR experience of this prototype car, right? That is like being inside of a prototype car is an experience that very few people get to do.
Oh, yeah. And even what you're saying with cardboard, like there's some value to both aspects of the experience. And mm-hmm. we were talking for an interior. You may like the benefit of having a photoreal render. Mm-hmm. as opposed to the experience of being able to lean forward and look around and,
sure.
and see all the things that you're going to see with that. So I think both aspects of it are a really great way of letting people experience something that may just not even be made yet.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. There's a lot of things that are advertised that aren't made yet.
Well, increasingly too.
Yeah.
We talk about, you know, we think it's a revolution in the way we're working, but the way that the people who are making products are working,
right?
They're working more virtually too.
Yep. That's true. All right. Well, we're just exactly at an hour, which has been awesome. I really appreciate this talk. I think it's fascinating for people.
Yeah.
It's been cool. I think people really, like we said, it's like this is a specialty area, and this is something you've been doing for 10 years in an area that I think most people didn't even know existed that much. You know, that's not which is great. I love what you guys are doing, obviously, with the VCA. That was something that we were pushing a lot a few years ago, and you guys adapted it. So
yeah, it's great.
And it makes sense. You guys are using it exactly the way that I think is the most beneficial. So really cool. Although the VCA is progressive rendering, and so therefore you don't see buckets, the tagline to the end of the show is, we're going to let the last bucket drop. So we're going to do that. And I hope you guys enjoyed it. All right. Thanks, guys. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.